If you really love the English language and pride yourself on using it well, you might find it frustrating to hear other native speakers doing it wrong. Like, do your fists clench when you hear somebody say Arctic when you know the correct pronunciation is Arctic? Do you worry that too much of that mistake will mean we lose the proper way to articulate the word? Well, just so you know, that's already happened once, because the right way used to be without that C sound in the middle. But the change happened so long ago, the mistake became the standard. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Like every living language, the way we define proper English is constantly changing. Young speakers in particular come along and make changes by mistake or the creation of slangy new words that feel fun or creative in the moment. Like it or not, once enough people have adopted what starts out as the wrong way to express something, bad English becomes standard English. And rather than fighting that evolution, Valerie Friedland is here to help us understand and embrace it. She's professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno, and author of Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Valerie, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm very excited to be here.
First thing to know is that as we get older, just as our skin loses elasticity and our joints may not move quite so easily, we also tend to lose linguistic elasticity. What does that look like?
Well, it looks like linguistic curmudgeonry most of the time, where we start to hear the things in the speech, particularly among young speakers or, you know, speaker groups we might not think so highly about, as bad, as wrong, as messed up, as decay. And you start to hear people say things like, oh my gosh, they're ruining the English language. You know, they need to start watching what they say. They need to learn to speak good English. And once you start hearing yourself say that, you've kind of reached that point of not having much elasticity left.
And this problem is actually more pronounced among people who are highly educated and financially well off. So we become, what, more apt to think other folks are doing English wrong because it's different from how we speak.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been taught since the time we're very, very young that there are certain ways to do things, and we cling really tightly to those beliefs that we have had inculcated when we're in grammar school or by our parents. And also, we tend to think the way we do things is the right way to do it. And it's not just a language that we feel that way about. We feel that way about a lot of cultural things, which is why cultural change goes hand in hand with language change, and we often resist both. So it's really just a matter of what we're used to, but also what we've been taught is correct. And I think it's that idea that we call it good and bad English that has really made us cling so strongly to these ideals we have about how people should talk.
This is so interesting because I think most people understand formal education will shape the way we speak. But you note linguistic differences of all kinds are shaped by social conditioning. And so they're affected by age and gender and ethnicity and economics and class and politics. Those effects are essentially what a sociolinguist studies. Is that right?
Exactly. So I'm really interested in the underlying structure of language. So how do our brains work to produce language, and how do our mouths work to produce language? So these very technical aspects of language, but more so about how they are negotiated, shaped, and changed by the social facts about us and about the world that we live in, and also about changes to our world that may be out of our control. So all of those things go into a big melting pot. And out comes language change most of the time.
How do we use the way we speak to signal we belong to a certain group?
Well, it's sort of an emergent thing. So when you are spending a lot of time with someone, you tend to talk more like them. And there are a lot of studies that show that even when we have limited exposure to people and we're in conversation with them, we tend to shift what we say, the style we talk in, towards each other. So if I'm talking about a bunny rabbit, you might call it a rabbit most of the time, but if I'm using the term bunny, chances are, if you're aligned with me and you're in conversation, you'll also call it a bunny. So we see that the more we talk with the same types of people as we are, the more we're going to shift our language towards them because we have a lot of reasons to. We're aligned with them, we want to communicate with them, and we spend a lot of time with them. So we might not be exposed to other people's norms. And therefore, we're going to shift together. And that's in separation from those that we are shifting apart from. So maybe it's by social distance. Maybe it's by geographic distance. We're separated from other speakers. So we simply don't have that exposure to them. And we often sometimes don't even like them or feel like we have that much in common with them, which will also affect how much we talk like them. And I think a great example is just look at British versus American speech. Social and geographic distance has made our different varieties of English shift even further away.
I've been studying up on Justice Clarence Thomas recently for a totally different interview, but it was interesting to learn in light of reading your book that he grew up a native speaker of the Gullah dialect or language and was apparently deeply affected by all the people who told him talking the way he was raised would harm his career prospects.
That is an extremely common thing among people that have gone to school in a system that suggests there's one way to speak English. And, you know, I think the trick is that it's okay to say for advancement, these are the norms that you'll be most likely rewarded for, and these are the ones that you won't. But to actually tell people that their speech is bad and wrong, I don't think we realize the damage that does psychologically to young children. I think it's perfectly fine to say there are varieties of English, and this is the variety that most professional circles use. This is the variety that most institutions use. But yours is perfectly healthy and rich and evolving, and it's simply not one that institutional norms have accepted. And can you see how that would make such a big difference in the way that we orient people to their own self-awareness, their own social groups, and their own culture? And I think Clarence Thomas is a great example. I've had other people that have gone on to achieve great things that have become very successful in various fields tell me the same thing, that they were shamed when they were young about the dialects they used and that they worked really hard to eradicate it from their speech. But then they have a cultural and social loss that I think we don't recognize.
Linguists have consistently found that young people, women, and members of marginalized racial and ethnic groups have an outsized impact on changing the language over time. This is so fascinating, Valerie, because it would seem the most powerful groups would have the most significant impact on the evolution of language. So why is that not the case?
Yes, I think we all think that, right? It's very common for us to just assume that those are who have power socially, politically, educationally, and economically will be the ones that move language forward. But they are also the ones that are more tightly in control of the various forms that they use linguistically and socially. So I think you could see with social change more generally that often those that are in the leadership positions, in the political and economic power positions in any one time and place, they're more resistant to the types of changes that start at a grassroots level. And language change starts very much like social change at a grassroots level. And it's often without even conscious awareness. But those that are more concerned about their speech fitting a certain ascribed norm are more controlling about the underlying natural inherent linguistic pressures that they allow to emerge in their speech. But we find that lower classes and women historically marginalized groups have less to lose by adopting these norms that come unconsciously into their speech, and actually more to gain because it helps separate them out as a group that has some cohesive identity. And a lot of times those subtle underlying variations that start to emerge in their speech naturally start to take on whatever qualities we associate with those groups or those speakers. And often those are quite positive, even if they're not powerful. So they might mean you're chill, you're aloof, you're carefree, you're cool, you're nonconformist, you're gangster, whatever that quality is, especially in adolescence, those things take on an attractive association. And then we find more and more speakers, as long as they identify with whatever quality is projected, adopt those changes until they start to just become what everybody does.
What gives women a particularly important role in shaping the way the next generation will speak?
Yes, that's a really fascinating finding that has been really overwhelming in sociolinguistic research and also sociohistorical research. It's not just women today that lead in change. It's women historically that seem to have led in change. And there are a number of different theories, and it probably has changed with the time. So in early modern speech, we find in women's letters and diaries this increasing use of verb forms like has and does over hath and doth, or also this increasing use of you for a subject pronoun over ye, because you is actually an object pronoun. We also see the increasing use of possessives like my and thy over mine and thine, instead of like mine eyen. You'd hear my eyes among women in women's letters. And it seems to be at that time partially related to the fact that women held a unique position where they were not highly educated nor literate, but they were intimately involved with men at all levels. So women were the ones that were talking to men no matter their social status. And women were often in more informal, intimate contexts and used language in those contexts. So, you know, when you're talking to your children or your close friends or to your husband, you're going to use a different kind of language than in a professional kind of circle. And so those types of situations tend to encourage the use of more informal variants that might be drawn from naturally occurring changes. And then they get spread across all social groups because women exist in all those social groups. And that seems to really be what spurred a lot of those early changes. In more contemporary speech, it's not that women are less educated or less learned, but it does seem to be that women seem to have a unique sensitivity to underlying linguistic changes. For example, intonational patterns. We found research that suggests that women might be more cued into subtle differences in intonational patterns. And so they seem also to be more cued into subtle changes in language that are occurring. And this might be tied to the roles as mothers and caregivers that make it necessary that they're more responsive to changes in language that might be at one point a new norm than other folk are.
So the knee-jerk reaction from some folks is that proper English today would not have flown with previous generations. It just now we speak it badly. But there's a reason that Canterbury Tales, and in some cases Shakespeare, felt like such a slog for most of us in high school, because we're not speaking anything like what people spoke centuries ago.
Absolutely. And actually, if you even go further back to Beowulf, which is Old English, we can't even read it. It's completely unintelligible. It's basically a different language. And so the funny thing is we react so strongly to change today and we lament how it's leading to the downfall of civilization. But if you actually look back to earlier periods, say between the 9th century and the 15th century, the types of changes that affected English were so much more massive than anything affecting English today, that is really when we should have been worried. And if we survive that, where basically case, plural marking, grammatical gender, verb classes all fell away with no impact on our language, then I don't think we really have anything to worry about today, because the rate of change, despite what many believe, has actually slowed significantly.
Really? That's so interesting.
It has.
I would think that social media would speed the way that language changes.
You know, a lot of people think that because you hear it so widespread, but vocabulary is a very different kind of spread of change than more impactful systemic changes that happen in language. So changes to verbs or changes to where we have plural markers or changing to how we pronounce things, those things really seem to need one-on-one purveyance. So you have to have conversations and communication in person to have that kind of thing happen. But a vocabulary word is very ephemeral. You can pick up a new word and then lose it tomorrow. And that does seem to be faster these days over social media, but it's not really impactful on the long-term course of language. So if I say riz, it's not going to do anything. You know, if I pick up a yeet and a riz and some little vocabulary words like that, my parents might not like it. But generally speaking, the impact on the system of language is negligible. So social media really doesn't seem to start change. It might help promote certain changes, but generally what it really does is spread vocabulary.
Valerie, why did the earliest English-speaking scholars not think their own language was worthy of academic study?
I think the other thing that surprises people is that the history of English as a learned language, of the language of institutions and law and medicine, is really, really recent. If you look back to the early modern period and before, so the Old English and Middle English period, English was solely a colloquial language. It was not used in any sort of context that would have been professional, that would have been religious. that would have been institutional. That was for Latin or French, which were considered the classical, learned, elite languages along with Greek. And it wasn't until the early modern period, until Shakespeare's time, when English started to ascend to those positions. It started to be viewed as perhaps a potentially decent language on its own. And that's probably part of the reason why we had such a massive change up to that point, because we didn't use it in those contexts which tend to codify language and therefore make it change less. And during Shakespeare's time, there were a lot of debates over how to enrich the English language. And it was called the Inkhorn Controversy, which was a debate, a vociferous debate, resembling much of our conflicts over language today, about whether we should borrow in words from Latin and Greek or use parts of Latin and Greek words and cobble them together to make new words, or if they should be more native-like to English. And you can even see some jokes in some of Shakespeare's works about those people that were bringing these fancy Greek and Latin combinations into the language because they came off kind of weird. But we needed new words. We needed to be able to talk about medicine and legal context and religion using English. And because we had never used it for that, we didn't have that kind of vocabulary. But English as a system was completely robust and ready for that kind of expansion. But that's why it's so funny that people think that the history of English has always been that there's one pure form of it, one correct form of it, because that's actually pretty much an 18th century invention.
So now there is English spoken in India and Canada and Australia and South Africa and Ghana and the U.S. and the U.K. There was a time when, you know, we were sort of geographically far away from these places. And so maybe we were linguistically far away. But now I can turn on Netflix and watch a TV show from any of those places and follow along. Are the differences, the divergences in English being minimized by the fact that we have a more global outlook these days?
No, I think what you find instead is that English as a language of communication has spread much farther and wider than I think we, our forebears, would have ever imagined. But the dialects are actually very robust. And if we look at the reasons why people use dialects, why people speak differently, varieties of the same language that vary but are the same language, it's because of the social identity that they project. It's because of the people we talk to most often. And again, listening to a TV show in a dialect that's not yours doesn't make you have any interest in adopting that dialect. The biggest impact we might find of those kinds of factors, those social media and television factors, might be vocabulary words. And sometimes if there are already underlying tendencies in a language that have been picked up by young speakers, you might find them propelled a little more by the social media or television shows. So a good example of that is like use has become a global phenomenon. And that's probably from watching television shows and getting social media from American English, even though like actually is a British feature and started well before the Valley Girls, but it came to our general awareness and became identified very strongly with American speech since about the 1980s. And that really has propelled its use far and wide. So in India, in Australia, all over the globe, you will find like used as Americans use it.
Over time, do societies tend to speak more like the upper crust or more like the hoi polloi?
Generally speaking, we move in the direction of lower class changes. So certainly there are some changes that are toward a more prestigious standard norm. So for example, the reintroduction of R sounds in American English in cities like Boston and New York. If we look since World War II, we find an increasing use of R in those areas because the external prestige norm of American speech was to become more R-ful. And that was sort of a top-down change. But if we look over the history of language, what we find is almost all the things that have changed over the course of time have been led by the lower classes. And what we say today is full of norms that were once initiated by the lower classes. A great example is progressive verb forms. I think most people think progressives are pretty decent and no one is objecting to them regularly, but in the 19th century, that was really the first time you started to see them used in writing because they were considered a low-class colloquial speech before that. Not to mention our H's that we've dropped in words like whip and white and wine. Those were very strongly marked as lower class in the 18th and 19th century, where you would have said whip, white, wine. And even Noah Webster said that those were careless and lazy and vulgar pronunciations in American speech. But today, no one says that. You would stand out if you said whip and whine, because everybody has already dropped them. So these were all lower class changes that have now become standard in our speech.
By the way, progressive verbs, for people who haven't been in an English class in a while, those are like verbs like with a helping verb and an ing on the second verb, right?
Yes, sorry. Yes, ing. Yes. So if you say I was walking, I was talking, I was going, those are all progressive forms of verbs.
I realize we could take the rest of the hour defending what are known in your line of work as filled pauses. In American English, these are those little non-words like and Is that right?
Yes, filled pauses are and and in other languages, they usually have a couple that are similar, like ano in Japanese, but almost all languages have at least two.
And what are they for?
That is such a fascinating question, because if you asked the person on the street, they would say they're for nothing. They're just to distract us and make us sound bad. But if you ask a psycholinguist who has studied them, they'd say they're for a number of really beneficial things that I think will surprise most people that have tried to eradicate them from their speech in business meetings and presentations. If you look at where they tend to occur, we find that filled pauses, and by that, again, I mean tend to occur most frequently when we're doing really hard cognitive work. And that means before we pick really hard words, difficult words, abstract words, less familiar, less common words. So instead of saying red, for example, vermilion, that an or would be more likely to occur before vermilion. They also tend to occur at the beginning of sentences a lot, because you were in your brain building the complex syntactic structure of that sentence. And we find the more syntactically complex a structure, the more likely a speaker will use an and an So they're actually really good markers that I'm doing a lot of cognitive work for you when we're in conversation. And then they also serve a communicative angle where they tell you as a listener when I use a or that I'm coming back. So don't jump in yet, because I'm about to keep going. And even more fascinating, if I that means expect a short delay. If I that means expect a longer delay, because we find that longer pauses tend to follow So it seems like they're doing some informative work for a listener at the same time. And the most fascinating and shocking thing, I think, for most people is not only do they help me know that you're coming back as a speaker and I should hang on before I jump in, but they also seem to flag for me as a listener that whatever's coming after the is a particularly difficult or abstract or less common word. And so it helps me prepare mentally to integrate new information more quickly and more efficiently, as well as even remember it better if I give you a pop quiz about an hour after we talk.
Wow. And males and females tend to use these filled pauses in different ways?
Yes, even more fascinating than all those good things they do for us is the fact that men and women seem to differ in terms of which ones they prefer and what they use them for. Men, by and large, use much more a whopping number of us more than compared to women, who use a lot more And part of this increased use for women seems to be driven by the discourse marking function that has recently taken over from things like well or so, where it occurs at the beginning of what you're about to say to either offset something that might be considered disaligning or dispreferred. So if I'm saying no to something, a lot of times an will come in first, because it's basically indicating to you that I'm giving this a lot of thought, but I'm still going to have to say no. So if you ask me on a date, I might say, you know, I'm busy. And what that sort of signals to you is I'm trying to be polite here. So it's kind of a polite hesitation marker. And that seems to be one of the uses that young women are doing more. And we find this not to be just a trend in American English, but almost all Germanic languages studied that both have those also are doing the same trend, where women are umming more than men.
It is fascinating to me the way that some words last for centuries, but their meanings change in pretty extraordinary ways. Will you give us a brief history of dude?
Sure. And dude is a great example of a word just like that. Dude started in the 1800s, and we find it really come to the fore in the late 1800s, around 1880, where it was used to call out men that were overly self-absorbed and really concerned with the way they dressed and being fashionable and beauty for beauty's sake. And they were often mocked or ridiculed as being outside the norm with masculinity. And a lot of times they were considered effeminate dandies. So it was really an insult at the time. You never called someone a dude and had them like it. In fact, it inspired many articles in the New York Times of the era about defamation lawsuits filed against people that called other people dude, or even duels that didn't end so well for the person who had claimed anyone was a dude. So it was really a significant insult at the time. If you start to look as we get towards the turn of the century, towards the turn of the 20th century, it starts to shift slightly. So it's not just calling out an effeminate fop type of personality, an Oscar Wilde type of personality. It starts to call out anybody who was overly concerned with the way they dressed or that showed up in a very brand spanking new uniform as a recruit for like the police academy or a fireman who had never used his uniform. So it was still about the clothes. And that's where we get that sense of a dude ranch. A dude ranch doesn't mean, you know, dude in the type of dudes we talk about today. It actually meant an out of dressed outsider that shows up on a ranch thinking they belong. So it was kind of a joke in that regard as well. And that's how dude ranches got their start. But around the 1930s or 40s, we see the zoot suiters and the African-American zoot suiters and the Mexican-American pachuchos that were really strongly involved in that movement called each other dudes. And they did it because they were calling out the extreme fashion that was so pivotal in defining a zoot suiter at the time, but also because it was an edgy counterculture kind of vibe that they were going for. And dude fit that counterculture, standing out because of one's clothes, but also this incredible subversive sort of thumbing the nose at mainstream culture that treated you as a rebel and often as a dangerous one at the time. And that is where we start to see the word dude infused with this counterculture, edgy, chill, cool kind of feeling. And that is how it got picked up in surfer and druggy subculture. And from there, it became attractive to men everywhere. And that is how we got the Big Lebowski kind of dude.
I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
This made me think about the fact that to my Gen Z children, use of punctuation in text messages sounds like formal and angry. They've had to get used to it from me because I guess I have lost my linguistic flexibility to write that way. But how do spoken language evolutions find their way into at least informal written communications?
You know, texting is a great example of a hybrid form of communication that combines the intimacy and casualness of spoken discourse with the more formal form or structure of written discourse. So it's really a great hybrid that we didn't have when, for example, I was growing up. I'm not going to age you there, so I'm going to assume maybe you had texting. But I did not
have texting. We had pencils.
And so we think of written language in one way. Those of us that grew up without that kind of hybrid communication, we think of it as more formal and needing punctuation and capitalization and this one form of written conveyance of information. But for people that grew up with chats and informal texts and communication mediated by computers, they have learned to communicate in a much more informal written forum. That doesn't mean they don't know how to use formal written speech. I've never gotten a student paper that had the informal hybrid texting, you know, style in it. I've never gotten that. So I think we can feel assured that that's not going to happen. But they have learned an additional thing that we old folks don't know. And that's how to use these very subtle little written cues to how to take the things we say. Because the problem when you start using the sensibility of spoken discourse in a written format is that the tone, the emotionality, the intimations, the subtleties, the nuances of spoken discourse can't be conveyed adequately through formal written language. So that's why we get emojis. That's why we get all lowercase. That's why we get the lack of punctuation, because those have taken on those subtle intonational patterns and intimate types of discourse that contractions and dropping your G's took on. They're communicating that message of, this is our relationship, and I'm going to tell you I'm feeling really happy with you and we're intimate, or I'm angry with you and I'm going to use all caps, or I'm angry with you and I'm going to use a period here. And so they've taken on those subtleties of spoken discourse that for people like you and me that didn't learn it as a native speaker, so to speak, we haven't gotten it yet. We're just not in on the trick.
Based on your knowledge of language evolution, what do you think are the chances we will broadly adopt some gender-neutral pronoun other than they to refer to non-binary folks?
I think it's unlikely. I think they really has won the day. It has been around for hundreds of years, used in a singular sense, even though that was more of an indefinite reference than the non-binary use that we see today. But the non-binary use has come out organically from that previous use. And whenever something emerges that's organic in our language, that happens because it's what speakers actually use, even in contexts that they had nothing before to use to draw from, and they just kind of inventively stick it in there, that tends to have a lot more staying power than anything we try to put on speakers. So, you know, how many people speak Esperanto today? None, pretty much, right? Because we put that on people. We said, here's an invented language. And so whenever we see pronouns thrown out, we've seen hundreds of pronouns since the 1800s that have been suggested for that context, but none has had the staying power of singular they. And I think that's because people can identify with it, people are familiar with it, and it's something everybody already used. So it doesn't take one person to say, okay, I'm a group that has the right and the authority to declare this new pronoun as what you should use, because it's hard for any one group to take that position. But they is something that's in all of our speech. And even if you don't admit it, you have used they in a singular sense. At some point when you say something like anybody should, who wants to do this should give their tickets to their friend, that kind of use where it's indefinite, almost everybody uses it that way. So it's kind of like that old pair of shoes. They feel much more comfortable than the new pair that you've never worn before. And that's why I think we don't have much hope for a new pronoun coming in to save the day.
Assuming we can make ourselves understood, is there such a thing as bad English?
Well, that's a pretty tricky question, because I think you could make up words that don't exist and violate basic rules of English. So for example, if I wanted to make up a word to name a new product I was coming up with, if I tried to start that word with an LP, you can't say a word with an LP in English as their initial onset. But in terms of the things that we call bad English that naturally evolve in young speakers' language or in subcultural use of language, they are not bad English in the sense that they're breaking any articulatory or cognitive rules. They're only disliked English in the sense that they're breaking social rules. So I think it's critical that we don't call them bad English, but it's perfectly fine to say, I don't like that form, as long as you realize that that's your personal social preference and not something that has anything to do with any inherent quality of one form being better or worse than any other.
Valerie Friedland is a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her book is called, like literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Valerie, thank you so much for the conversation.
Absolutely. It was great fun being here. Thank you for having me.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.